So just a very, it was really, I think it was a very beautiful panel, also the juxtaposition of the three different works. And my only thought, comment, also reflecting a little bit what was said by Shlomit at the end, is just the, to what extent this kind of work, when you have a therapist, and maybe I'm replacing Erin, who was a bit sick this morning and couldn't be here, so to ask maybe her question, like, or what are we learning from this work, or what is this kind of methods of therapy and so forth, about are they the therapy for the therapist or for the so-called patient, autistic, what extent, who is actually modifying? And I think we saw some interesting data from Netta that actually maybe it's the changes in the, and I think all three actually, changes in the caregiver therapies that are actually what is being indexed here. And what does that teach us about neurotypicality and neurodiversity?
You will collect answer and response. Yeah, Tommy?
Thank you. Excellent session. I have two quick comments to Rachel. First, that you were wondering how to deploy this mirror game as an intervention. And to that, I know that Fred Cummins is working on an online version of the mirror game, so that would be a nice web application that you could then use to play with. It's with the Leap controller, so kind of very simple motion controller that you have. And the other comment is to the result that you showed, that they were not significantly, but the autistics were more confident in their when they were leading. And that kind of resonates with lots of experience that I've had, or the little experience that I have kind of resonates with that, in that the probably linked to what was discussed yesterday as well, that for when you're doing the mirror game and when you are leading, you also have this second consciousness, or this kind of second, you know, I'm the leader, but I also have to, you know, wonder whether you can follow me when I'm doing this. And maybe there's something that this kind of doesn't engage as much, and so the autistic person is much more free to just do their own thing and be confident in what they are doing. And this, we've shown this in tapping as well, or seen this in tapping as well, that the if you look at who's leading and who's following, it is the therapist who's following the autistic person, pretty much, not much the other way around. Thanks.
Rachel, I think we've discussed this before when you first presented this to me, but this comes back also pertaining to all your three. Following, leading, trying to find synchronization, I think it has to do a lot with trust and emotional state of both participants, and I wonder how much touch, as an analogy to even like the cultural shaking hand, kissing, hugging, hello, how much that interaction brings this perhaps secure place that might change the results of the different experiments.
Thank you. I have a few questions. So first for Netta. Have you thought about measuring the far-reaching implications of this musical therapy? And if so, how would you plan on measuring that? And then another question is both... Sorry, I know it's really hard. I'm genuinely curious, though.
Yeah.
And then the next question is for both Netta and Rachel. If you guys know of any studies that talk about how frequently improvisation or any kind of interventional therapy needs to be done in order to prolong the effects that that it would have.
I am, and I got very curious about these basic motor skills and the sensory motory loop coupling, however you want to call it. I work since many years in the individual sessions with children, nonverbal. They don't speak, so there's no choice, no other choice than really working on that, what I call kinesthetic attunement, so on a physical level. And I'm curious also what you, Rachel, how you put it into practice, because I see the need to reduce it to just like mirroring or to simple things you can analyze as a scientist. But the reality is very different. It's very complex, and it needs to have really a lot of experience and skills in relating, in creating that attunement with the children who communicate differently.
It's very interesting study that you select a particular clinical population. I'm just wondering, like, among us, even we are not clinical diagnosed, each of us have a different kind of tendency socially. So is this observed pattern only among normal and clinical population, or even within the normal population, there's a continuum profile, except that they are extreme and we are the other extreme? I'd like to hear what you think.
Yeah, I'm wondering if anybody has comments on the if there's any evidence on the subjective experience of the person with autism at moments that are characterized as co-confident, because that's a characterization that is that how it feels on that other end, or is it not that?
Let's take two more comments and then hear from the speaker. So, Pavel and someone else.
I would like to continue the comments about therapeutic effect of music therapy. So do you think this effect is situational for this specific interaction with this specific therapist, or these children with autism really required some social skills in communication?
Last chance for a quick comment. 1, 2, 3, good. So let's go with a rhythm. Neta, you want to start? And you have like... 3 to 4 minutes, 3.
Okay. Gonna yes, nail it. It's fine. We're gonna solve it all. Solve it all.
Try to distill your...
So in terms of far-reaching implications and evidence beyond the therapy room, so there's been quite, especially in music therapy and autism, there have been quite a few formal trials, randomized controlled trials, to try and see if there's a carryover between what's happening in the sessions and what's going on externally. And they've tried to look at a number of things, including indicators for social interaction. Some of those have found significant positive effects. And so there's definitely now, it's considered that there's now an evidence base for that kind of intervention for certain kinds of outcomes. But there's a lot still to think about in that context. They're quite specific, they're quite controlled. And a lot of music therapists have kind of questions about how transferable those kind of studies might be. But generally speaking, that it's kind of accepted within a certain community anyway, that particularly for autism, there does seem to be an effect. In terms of frequency, there is currently a randomized controlled trial looking at whether 3 times a week music therapy as opposed to 1 time a week makes a difference. So that whole world of outcome is being really explored. The question about touch, I think, is really interesting. It's quite notable how in the videos that I've seen, the therapist and client tend not to go near each other. In terms of touch, they do get close sometimes because the therapist is kind of doesn't give the client where to go. So there are differences in proximity, but certainly not so much on touch. And in terms of who's the therapy for and who's modifying, well, we can talk for hours. I think we have noticed in various ways how the therapists change and adapt. And it's really important to constantly be thinking about who it is that's making judgments about change. Quite often, in the therapeutic context, it's the therapist. And so there's a kind of internal logic there that's running the show. But therapists are aware of that. I don't know about other therapies, but in Nordoff Robbins music therapy, that's considered something that people are trying to think about. And then the last thing to say would be about music therapy being seen as part of this continuum of music making. So there are some people who say it's just one extreme way of music therapy being somehow helpful or music being somehow helpful, and then it kind of leads on to community music and other kinds of music making. The danger with that, I think, is that it ends up turning music into the well-being pill, and it's just more than that. So there's a thing that we need to be careful about there. Was that 3 minutes?
Perfect.
I just need 1 or 2 minutes and I will pick your remark also about what's changed. The point is that the interaction is changing, both of us, if you are to improvise together. So the teacher is changed too, but is an expert in the techniques of interaction. Especially in that pedagogy, it's not technical skills of the individual players, but these are real techniques of how to interact. And by using this expertise, the teacher can use the properties of the collective dynamics to induce something in the other. So is changed, and he tells me so very often that since we work together, he has a different vision of what he's doing with the learners. So clearly, he's also changed, and this is good because we want to propose this pedagogy to others, so other future teachers should be changed by the pedagogy itself. But since the expertise, there is this asymmetry. And so this leads me to my own comment. Most of us are studying synchronicity in interaction, and we sometimes forget the question, is synchronicity important and why? And is it more important to be synchronous or to handle the various modes of coordination that exists and to regulate? Maybe non-synchronicity is more important because this is an opportunity to repair coordination and to negotiate a new kind of coordination. And this is how new meanings can emerge. So maybe this is a comment you can.
Thanks.
Yeah, so thanks for all the lovely questions. And I'd love to continue a lot of the questions that were raised here and afterwards, because I'm not going to be able to answer everything. So first of all, yes, I'm going to go from the last to the first. But definitely, I loved Tommy's idea of from yesterday about the non-confidence moments and exploring those. So Michael's question about the subjective experience. First of all, there's a study by Leo and Julia looking at subjective ratings of players, and they also looked at physiological measures of synchronization during the mirror game. And indeed, these moments of co-confident motion correlated with this subjective sense of togetherness. In our study, we are looking at global measures. So right after the game ends, the participant goes and fills out a little questionnaire and reports on their subjective experiences. I go into the room and write down what I felt, and I haven't looked at the data yet, but we'll see. Regarding the continuum with neurotypical individuals, absolutely, that's very much a direction that we're looking at. And I couldn't report on all the measures we're collecting here, but in the neurotypical group, we're also collecting questionnaires about autism symptoms using the SRS, the social responsiveness scale, and definitely it's a direction that more broadly our lab is looking at with Navid-David Binoun's studies and so forth. Thomas's comment about the attunement, the BMC influence, definitely very, very rich area. Also related to Ella's question about the touch, and as a contact improviser, one of the main limitations I see in the mirror game is that you don't touch. So definitely, very curious about exploring that. And I don't know if this answers your question, Thomas, so much, but we are doing another parallel study looking at a biofeedback intervention for adults with autism. So these are obviously all verbal individuals because we have to teach them how to do it, but we basically hook them up to a machine that measures their heart rate and their skin galvanic response, and we teach, they see it on a screen as sort of this fun video to watch instead of these graphs, and we teach them to become more attuned to their own breathing, right, and their own stress responses. And the proximal, so we're doing this randomized controlled trial, and the proximal goals of this study is to, reduce anxiety levels. But what I'm really curious about is, okay, so we know that individuals with autism have difficulty, recognizing their own body, their own internal states, their emotional states on a bodily level. What if I can teach this individual to recognize, what is the difference between feeling angry versus feeling afraid versus, and then can I use that to then enhance their empathy towards others? Right, so that's another study that we're doing. Do I have more time? So to Asaf's comment, definitely, there's a big confound in that I'm the researcher who's also doing the game, and one of the things that we're going to be looking at is have my emotion traces changed over time, and do they Are they different when from when I play with a neurotypical versus an autistic individual? And it might be that, you know, I'm subconsciously turning on this, oh, I need to attune more, you know, when I'm playing with individuals with autism. But, and we do have a little bit of a comparative sample because there was another, a previous research assistant who was doing this before me. He quit midway. So a little bit of comparative sample, and we found, so the levels of CC that I had with everyone across the board were much higher than he had had. And part of it, I think, is has to do, so this is what my research assistant observed when she was looking at the videos. And she said, you know, my emotions tend to get a little bit repetitive. And so maybe it's easier for the individuals with autism to follow. So it's just a sort of an individual characteristic that I have as a dancer that is then feeding in and, you know, a whole complicated picture. So just the tip of the iceberg.
Let's have a round of applause to our panel speakers.